Hello, and welcome to the Internet of Senses Institute podcast. Each episode, we will hear from thought leaders, inventors, researchers, and others who are shaping our future through sensory technology. Here is your host for this week's podcast episode.
My name is Julia Sion. I'm a researcher and industry expert in haptics and wearable technology, and I will be hosting today's episode. Today, we will be discussing the genesis and evolution of haptics and tactile interfaces, and their implications for society with David Parisi. David is a professor of emerging media at the College of Charleston, and David explores the digital mediations and technological extensions of tactility. Hi, David.
Hi, Julia.
Thanks for having this time to chat with me today. Really happy to have you here. So I just want to tell you that I was actually very impressed and pleased to know that there is someone like you who is writing and researching about the history of tactile sense and tactile interfacing. Because I'm a researcher myself in this industry, and knowing that there is a formal history of haptics makes me very proud and hopeful about the future of this research direction. So thanks for doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciate your sustained attention to my work here.
Yeah, I was researching very extensively, and I really love your book, Archaeologists of Touch, which I will use many quotes from this book to kind of form my questions. So I'd like to open our conversation with a very short question. It might be silly, but I wanted to include it and hear your opinion about that. So the question is the following. Why do touch and tactile technology deserve their own history? What is so special about those?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's a silly question at all. I think it's a really great question. And it I think the answer to the question depends on where you're coming at the subject from, right? So, you know, for me, as a media historian, as a media theorist, I'm interested in the way that people working on haptics, people working on touch technologies, have tried to transform the sense of touch through technology, right? And they're very explicit in their aims. We want to make touch like seeing and hearing through the design of media technologies specific to touch, right? That is a goal, in the engineering literature, in a lot of the industry work. That's a very explicitly stated goal. So for me, it's really productive to show people in my field what's been happening in haptics, which is an area that they largely haven't looked at. So that's my angle on it. If you're in the field of haptics, I think it's really helpful to gain a sense of where the field came from, to maybe not do quite as much wheel reinvention as people in haptics seem to do. A lot of times, I'll read a study from 2015, and a similar study was done in 2002, right?
Yeah, that's an important thing. Yeah. To not reinvent the wheel. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And then finally, I think that this history is just, I don't want to say it's inherently compelling, but I do think that getting a window onto the way that people have thought about touch, going all the way back to the 1700s, is really illuminating, just to see how people have grappled with this very elusive and very slippery sense, right? It's proven to be a really hard sense to pin down, to study, to understand. And I think the same stories get told, if we look back at the end of the 1800s, the early researchers on touch are telling the same stories as people are telling today. No one's paying attention to this. It's neglected. Yes. How do we approach it?
Actually, I realized that we didn't move that far from 19th century, actually, even though I think we are already in the fifth phase, according to your history timeline, right? We actually maybe somehow in certain aspects still maybe in the third or maybe even in the second stage in the certain aspects of fundamentals of understanding the tactile sense. The other question that I have is that related to your work in general. So in your work, you explore the differences between technology, scientific approach to touch technologies and the cultural ones, right? And I sense in your opinions and how you write about it that there is some mismatch you see, right, between these two. Mismatch and like a difference, right, in what we can offer technologically wise in terms of fidelity, etc., and what the expectations of the future potential users are and what the marketers tell us. Can you talk a bit more about these differences or mismatches?
Yeah, I mean, I think it ultimately comes down to a question of is haptics going to be additive or is it going to be transformative? In other words, is it going to add something that is missing, but not ultimately that powerful, or is it going to be a technology that fundamentally reorganizes our society? It, you know, from the way that we shop to the way that we interact socially with people. And I think the mismatch is between the way it looks in the lab. It looks like it's going to be transformative, and for proponents and especially for marketers, the promises are always of radical transformation. Utopian transformation in a lot of cases. This will be better than what we had before, right? And there's so that's the promise on the one hand, and then there's this sort of lived reality on the ground with touch technologies. You know, going back to the first commercially available haptics devices, let's say 30-ish years ago, we're really still in the age of like vibrating alerts and rumble, right? And video game controllers. So we still haven't seen, you know, we've got this more recent wave of product releases, gloves and vests, but they're still not that widely distributed. So you get this, these broad promises of sweeping transformation made around the technology. And how does it manifest in our day-to-day use? It manifests in, you know, vibrating smartphones and vibrating video game controllers. So I think that gap is really substantial. And it's a gap that enthusiasts of the technology don't quite seem to be productively grappling with, I would say. Like, there's an assumption that if we build it, they will come, right? Like, if we just make cool enough technologies, everyone will want them. And I don't quite see that everyone will want them side of things manifesting.
Why do you think people would not want that? What is missing there?
I mean, I think part of it is that people seem to be getting along just fine without them, right? With some rare exceptions, right? I mean, I think that haptics definitely has its uses, and that these sort of transformative promises made around the technology, there's some ground to them. But at the same time, the sort of value proposition, what is this $2,000 device going to add to my life that is currently missing? I think that value proposition is a little bit lacking for people in their day-to-day lives, right? So it's a promise of a seamless integration of a technology into their lives, and the technology itself is not seamless, right? So if you ever put on a vest or put on a glove, these are cumbersome technologies to use. They take some acclimation, cultural acclimation to their use. It takes training to use these devices. And the promise is always, oh, it's going to feel really natural. It's going to feel really intuitive. There's nothing natural about, you know, putting on a 3 or 4 pound glove or strapping on like an electric shock vest.
Is it a problem of fidelity, right? And if we have this fidelity that can really replace the real touch, or is it about the context of use, right? One thing is to have like this gaming industry and you have like very specialized ways of using haptic devices, versus daily user, right? Those that are hungry of touch that the companies try to tell us, right? Are we really hungry of touch, right? Of real tactile sensations or experiences, or is this just a marketing situation that happens? So I wonder if there is a real future for that everyday use for haptic devices, aside from very specialized industry-based kind of gaming type of uses. But anyways, let's go back. Actually, let's move towards your book, The Archaeologist of Touch, amazing book. I really enjoyed reading it. And I really love how you organize the history of touch and tactile interfaces, or haptic interfaces. And by the way, I think that's you brought up very important thing that we should distinguish tactile versus haptics, right? One is active, another is a passive touch, because usually in industry it's kind of used interchangeably. So maybe sometimes I will use haptic, but I mean tactile interface. So just because it's already kind of overused like that in the industry. Anyways, in this book, you organize the history of tactile technology through five phases, right? So would you be able to kind of describe each phase using one, two sentences for our audience? I think it would be really nice to have this like express history excuse.
Yeah, let me take a shot at that. So the first phase, which I sort of date to roughly the 1740s, maybe like an odd starting point for a history of haptic interfaces. But for me, that first phase is defined by the use of touch to know and apprehend and study electricity. So electricity is this thing that's very hard for people to understand in the 1700s. One of the ways that they understand it, one of the ways that they know it, is by touching it. And it is uniquely, electricity is uniquely accessible to touch in comparison to the other senses. Electricity has this cultural life in the 1700s and on into the 1800s. And that cultural life is in some ways defined by its touchability. What happens when I feel an electric shock? What happens when I feel an electric eel? What happens when I feel an electric battery? What does that do to my body? So that's the first phase, basically a tactile epistemology, knowing electricity through touch. It's a very structured way of touching electricity. And the second phase begins roughly in the 1820s with the experiments by Ernst Heinrich Weber on tactility. He's interested in mapping the two-point threshold on the skin, so that the smallest distance at which you can perceive a distance between two stimuli, that really sort of creates the basis for a system of experiments, scientific experiments on touch carried out throughout the 19th century, continuing on into the 20th century. And then at the end of the 19th century, they come up with a name for that. They use an old name for that. They use this word haptics to describe the doctrine of touch. And for me, that's really sort of this crucial moment when you get the coherence of a formal field of inquiry, a formal field of study around touch. So haptics for me is, you know, very much a 19th century science that gains new life in the 20th century. The third phase is defined by a series of attempts that is specifically drawing on that science of touch to create new communication technologies, electric mechanical communication technologies, informed by the science of touch to route communication messages through the skin. So whether that's messages originally intended through for the ear that are routed through the hand, messages originally intended through the eye that are routed through the skin, or Frank Gehlard's tactile Morse code vibratees that he develops in the 1950s. So this is, you know, roughly the 1920s onward. And I should say that that these phases, so they're successive, but they're not, one phase doesn't necessarily end and another one begins. They sort of overlap in a lot of interesting and productive ways. You know, it's, and obviously this is contestable too, right? This is just my way of organizing the history. Someone else might go at it and hit it another way. The fourth phase dates back to the late 1960s and involves attempts at adding touch feedback onto existent modes of interfacing with computers. So how can we productively add touch feedback onto an audiovisual interface, allowing us to touch and feel objects in computer-generated space? And this is really sort of the precursor to contemporary, you know, VR force feedback gloves. Basically a series of sustained attempts, primarily in university context, but also in industry context, to add touch feedback onto computers. This really accelerates in the 1980s and 1990s. We get the fifth phase roughly in the early 2000s, but probably dated a little bit before that, which involves attempts to convince the public. This is like, how do we bring this technology to market? And this involves attempts to convince the public that there's a need for haptic interfaces, right? That the production of desire for haptic interfaces. How do we convince you that this is something that is essential and fundamental and missing in your life and you have to have it? So that's basically the skeletal outline of the book. And I would say at this point, I'm confident that we could even add a sixth phase.
That's what I wanted to ask.
Sure.
Can you predict?
Yeah, I mean, I would say this is not even a prediction, but almost more of an observation that something does happen. I stopped research for the book roughly in 2015, so that's where it closes. I think something crucial happens with this recent rediscovery of VR and the bringing a new wave of products to market, which we've seen just in the last 5 or so years. And this is really sort of a testing ground for a lot of the technology that was developed, from the 1980s on. It's a testing ground for a lot of the marketing discourse around touch. We only had, a few dedicated haptics devices prior to 2015 that were actually brought to, mass market. And we've seen a lot more of them, subsequent to 2017. So I think we're in this sort of new phase of testing. Testing the public interest and public desire for these technologies. And we're going to see, how much these efforts succeed and how much they sort of fail over the next few years.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Are you planning to continue actually the history, writing about this?
Definitely.
Or what's your plan?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of where I'm at now. I'm really trying to get my head around. I mean, it's hard to study emerging technology as it's emerging. It's a lot easier mm-hmm. to go back and look historically at it and to sort of take a moving snapshot of the field in progress. But I think it's a really exciting time to be studying the technology just because you have so much stuff being thrown against the wall to see what sticks at this point. There's three or four haptic vests currently commercially available. That was not true a decade ago, right? So they use different configurations of stimuli. They use, some use vibrations, some use electricity. Which one of those is going to, if one of them wins out, which one is it going to be? Those are incredibly fascinating questions. I don't have a great answer for which one is going to win out, but I think it's really interesting to track how that technology emerges and where its uses, where it finds its uses.
And also the acceptance changes, right? So it's more acceptable to have some wearable devices than it was before, right? We have the whole industry of electronic textiles, right? Creating do-it-yourself industry that creates all kind of, garments with some, of course, simple vibration motors and all other modalities, but it's, I guess, society is more ready to accept certain things than it was before. So it might be helpful as well. It'll be very interesting to see where it goes. So I'm very excited. All right. So moving forward with the phases. So I'd like to touch upon the third phase, because I think it was kind of fundamental in a sense that this phase was kind of based on three groups of devices, right? And you mentioned one type of devices were kind of based on speech sound for fingers, right, projecting. And then the other group would be projecting actual images via vibration of the skin. And the third group of devices was based on Morse code, like arbitrary haptic symbols. So essentially, we see kind of like a birth or foundation of haptic language as we know it now, right? So my question is the following: does the contemporary tactile language have any alternatives, or maybe new principles and semantics appeared in comparison to this third wave?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question, and it depends on where you're asking it, right? So if you are asking it in the research lab, I think maybe you have some established principles there. If you're asking it in the consumer space, I think it's a little bit, we're still in that throwing stuff against the wall phase, right? We keep seeing companies try to develop more robust tactile languages, right? We have simple vibration notification systems that are fairly intelligible. But whenever companies have tried to develop more nuanced tactile languages, they seem to have fallen short. And I'm thinking of efforts by Apple with the Taptic Engine. I'm thinking of efforts by Immersion with its instinctive alerts. So any attempt at layering, you know, sort of a formalized vocabulary onto tactile, computer-generated tactile sensations seems to fall fairly well short. And we're left with, I think still in 2022, we're left with a very simple language of, you know, notification vibrations. That again, depending on the device might send you a more complex signal. The question is if you read that signal, right?
So that's the question, exactly. Are we closer to understanding our body, the skin, in terms of projecting another type of language to it, or we are not there yet? So we can project anything we want, right? But we need to project something that body or our skin interface can understand. But to do that, we need to understand this skin interface first. So
yeah, I mean, this is where I think it's, you know, it's helpful to look back at, especially the work done in the 50s and 60s around tactile communication. The foundation was all there at that point in terms of discerning or identifying discernible tactile characters. The question was really one of training and willingness of people to submit themselves to this sort of complex training that it would take to decode these, you know, these tactile messages. And I think that's the real challenge, right? Like if my phone or my watch vibrates and it sends me a message that I have an incoming call from my dad or an incoming call from my wife, and those are two different messages, materially distinguishable messages, and I don't read them as distinct messages, does it matter that they're materially distinct? And this really gets at the cultural aspect of this project, right? Like, to what extent are people willing to, you know, willing to learn those new tactile languages? I think that's a really, you know, that's a really fascinating question. I think we have learned them sort of tacitly, but not explicitly in a lot of cases, right? So I understand pretty well the different notifications that come from my smartwatch. But I never learned them formally, right? Like I never.
But that's the thing. Do we need to learn? Because if you're talking about the real touch, right? The real tactile sensation, we don't need to learn anything. We perceive it on the go, right? It's so natural to us. It's like it's connected to our emotions, right? So can we do something like this with mediated touch, using mediated touch technologies? So here I'm just thinking, is there is another set of completely another set of language, which is not even called a language, because the moment we call something language, it requires training and learning and all that headache. So can we go around this headache and make it so intuitive using mediated touch? So is there a way, is there opportunity for that? It's kind of a rhetorical question.
I think it's
something that I'm very curious in my research. So, because initially I was so much motivated by the fact that real tactile sense is so powerful in conveying information quickly and not simple information, because if we are talking about notion of emotion, it's a very complex abstract information, but real tactile sense, we can do it very quickly. But if we take mediated touch technology or language, tactile language, that's going to become very cumbersome. So bridging with two is the question that I'm always wondering about. I was curious.
I mean, I think that what this comes down to, and it's really like it's very fundamental, is the question of where does instinct come from, right? And is there such a thing as biological instinct, and if so, you know, how significant is that, and how much of instinct is learned, right? So, you know, immersion certainly thought with its instinctive alerts that it had identified, you know, instinctive tactile characters that would not need to be learned. I didn't agree with that. I thought that was a lot of sort of marketing rhetoric. But I think a lot of this depends on your orientation, you know, toward that question of nature versus nurture. How much of our tactile vocabulary is learned, but learned so early that we don't think of it as learned, so that it just appears as instinct.
So it's about the time, like the duration of training, basically. How can we minimize it in a way?
Yeah, or and also reflecting on where things that we think are instinctive might have come from, like to what extent those things that appear instinctive, that appear natural, are a result of cultural training or are a result of learning. And if you go back to Weber, it's really fascinating. In his book, he basically talks about that process of learning to distinguish tactile sensations from one another. He thinks that is something that happens so early on in our development that we forget it ever happened. So it looks natural, but it is actually developmental and it's learned. But it's learned so early on that we forget that it's learned. It's a really fascinating approach to, you know, to that question of what is inherent and what is learned, what's involved, what involves training, what involves learning, and what involves, you know. Yeah. And again, like if we take this back, the premise of Robert Galt's Teletactor was basically the brain is plastic, that if you just brute force these sound sensations through the hand long enough, eventually your brain will start interpreting those tactile sensations as speech sounds, right? So there's sort of a theory of learning baked into the like design and ideation of all these technologies that I think is really fascinating.
Yeah, plasticity of brain and stuff. It's all the question how much effort you want to put into it and why, right? What's the reason for that? And actually, it's connected to my next question about the fifth phase, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I'm going for each of them. So, you know, as you mentioned, that in this phase, we have this marketing campaigns, right? The industry like Apple, Immersion Corporation, and others are trying to kind of put this message that humanity lacks or needs more tactile sensations, right? And that tactile interfaces or displays can alleviate that need for more tactile sensations, right? And as I understand, you do not really buy this message, right? Or kind of promotional text of these corporations. So then my question is the following. If humanity does not really need more tactile sensations, then what is the real benefit of tactile interfaces or displays? What could be their actual benefit from them?
Yeah, this is such a fascinating question to push on. You know, I think if you are going to posit that we are somehow touch deficient, right, that we need more touch, that something fundamental has been stolen from us by our over-reliance on screens, which is an argument that I'm sympathetic to. But if you make that claim, then you're also positing there's a correct amount of touch, and there's an amount of touch that if you fall below that threshold, you are somehow deficient. So what you end up with is you end up with a normative model of touch. If you don't have this much touch in your life, you are somehow deviant, right? If you don't want more touch, you are somehow deviant. And I had this conversation with my students last week when we were talking about haptics, and there was sort of a not necessarily a consensus on how much touch they wanted in their lives, right? So if you're making that claim about whether it's an emotional need for touch or a functional need for touch, again, I think the problem is that it is offering a normative model of how much touch someone should want in their lives. And I think that's, you know, that's an issue. In terms of the benefits that the technology can offer us, I do think there are some real like tangible things that we can point to, if you'll, tangible things we could point to around touchscreen interfaces, right? Where it's just hard to use touchscreen interfaces, especially when you're driving without tactile feedback, right? So in terms of that question of efficient interfacing with a display or with a device, how do you accomplish the thing that you want to accomplish quickly and effectively? I think there's some real benefit to touch feedback there that is, again, like contextually specific, application specific, that we can point to and say, like, yes, adding touch feedback here, we took it away when we went away from physical buttons, knobs, and sliders. So there are some benefits to adding back something that approximates those sensations. I think, again, like in those very narrow circumstances, we can point to haptics and say there's a real benefit. Here.
So it's about functionality more than kind of emotional affective need. that is so appealing to marketers.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not minimizing the importance of touch and affect, right? Like, I do think it's really powerful. I just don't necessarily think that it's universal, right? And you know, people's reactions to the pandemic and to social distancing are really illustrative here, right? Like, you have some people who are really hurt by this sudden withdrawal from interpersonal affective touch. And you have other people who were compelled to touch people, right? So that sort of forced social touch. Oh, I didn't want to shake this person's hand, but I was expected to, so I did. I didn't want to hug this person, but I was expected to, so I did. All these power dynamics that play out in our experiences of interpersonal touch, that I think people who study haptics in the lab neglect those power dynamics. You know, I think hapticians tend to have a very weak theory of power. And as such, they overestimate the amount of touch that people want in their lives.
Well, yeah, because I think, and I can talk probably a little bit for people in the lab, because we are so much into this field, we want it to be there, right? We want to invest in it. So we definitely are believing in certain things more than probably necessarily needed. But and I also noticed in the research communities during the pandemic, lots of researchers are quoting right now this pandemic, you know, post-pandemic need for more touch. Look, during COVID, the touch was so much needed. That's why haptic tech is needed. So there is a link, right? So people try to kind of justify, and I mean, we'll see how it goes. As you say, it's a normalized way of seeing things in that sense. So, yeah, thanks for sharing on this part.
Could I just, because you brought up we're talking about the pandemic a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think it's really, it's significant that during the pandemic, there was no successful haptics technology that was deployed to, right? So you have this research field that's been around for, let's just talk about, you know, computer haptics has been around for 30 years by the time the pandemic hits. I go out, I buy a webcam to put on my desk. I buy like a nice microphone to put on my desk for my Zoom setup so that I can have this, you know, better audio visual interface. And there's no off the shelf solution to add touch to that interface, right? So to me, it was a really big test for the technology. You know, maybe it's a question that it wasn't mature enough, but if it wasn't mature enough, why not, at, you know, 30 years in? But it was a really big test for the technology that no one developed something that could add like anything haptic to that experience of, you know, video conferencing, right? That's really significant. So as much as it might demonstrate that there's a need there, like in this touch hunger, the skin hunger narrative, mm-hmm. might demonstrate that there's a need there, it also might demonstrate that there's not a need, right? Because there was not a product, you know, immersion has been around since 1993. They didn't have anything ready to go that was like the Logitech camera for touch, right? Just wasn't there.
Right. But let's say if it's accessible, right? And it's there, the fidelity is there and accessibility is there in terms of costs. I mean, about by accessibility in this case. And let's say we distribute to everyone and let's see, and then take it away. Let's see if there is a need for that. So that's why I'm very much pro, like in the field studies, right? Like in the wild, because one thing is in the lab to understand the fundamentals, but then when you launch it in the field, in the real life, you discover so much more, right? About the context, about kind of real needs and how it has been used. So we'll see how it goes. We need more tech, maybe, I don't know, and accessibility. Well, anyways, let's move forward with the kind of area touching upon the social aspects. In your latest article, Can Touch This, you mentioned something very powerful, I think. And let me quote you here. It's a longer sentence. You said, or you kind of asked, if someone finds that the golden ratio of ergonomics, haptic fidelity, and cost, will haptics be liberatory, restorative, and humanizing, or will it ultimately prove to confine, exploitative, and dehumanizing? And then you voiced skepticism about this humanizing and liberating aspects. Well, have you thought about ways of making it more humane then, or possibly ways of protecting future users from harmful consequences?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think part of the problem is it goes back to something that you just brought up a second ago, which is we don't know how this is going to look once it gets out into the wild, right? So I think the way that we answer those questions depends on the form it takes if it gets out into the world in like any sort of like mass, at any sort of mass scale. What does the technology look like in that instance? And I think that will give us a clue as to how we answer some of these questions. But I also don't think it's too early to start thinking about ethics in haptics technology. And I think the field of haptics is a radically interdisciplinary field. It's one of the things that's always fascinated me about it. It's got tributaries from all over: robotics, psychophysics, engineering. It's got all these different fields of research that are necessary in order to make the technology work at all, right? Just because haptics is so hard to get right. And the one thing that has been sort of dramatically absent for me in the literature is any discussion of ethics, any discussions of privacy, very minimal discussions of consent. And you can make the argument that it's still too early to do that. That the technology is not necessarily mature enough that we need to be asking those questions. But my concern there is that if you don't ask those questions early enough, then they won't be baked into the design from the start.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think at some point we'll get to a place where we need to talk about what are sort of baseline ethical standards for haptics research, for haptics technology. Do we limit the type of data that we collect on users when they're using an interface? And I know some companies that I've spoken to have been very enthusiastic about the ability of their devices to capture biometric data about their users. That scares me, right? That capturing biometric data is baked into the financial model, the commercial model of the technology. That's really troublesome. And I think it speaks to, the sort of umbrella issue here, which is that all this technological development is happening within, a capitalist ecosystem where products have to ultimately make money and produce a return on investment, right? So what does it mean for Meta to be funneling money into haptics research? How are they hoping to monetize or recoup that investment? That's really, concerning to me, given if we're looking at that company in particular, given their ethical issues around data collection, with Facebook and with Instagram. So
just like they're giving away our most private parts, the leftovers, right? Our bodies. And it's just scary. It's scary how it can be potentially used. Going back to also why we need to talk about ethics early on, right? Even from the perspective of like utilitarian design process, it's very important to talk about ethics right away. I'm teaching this course right now, and I gave this article to my students during this design process. Like, they have their projects, they have to design some wearable technology using haptic feedback. And I told them, guys, please read this article and think about those implications, because it also influences about the form factor, how you provide the inputs versus output, right? Small things like this, but it's also about privacy, how you place the motors, where they're located, and what kind of data you're gathering and why. And also, how do you educate the users about these issues, about the possibility of their data being stolen or misused? That's very, very important. Well, let's then close up the conversation with my last question for you. So, which is related to learning from the past, the classical question about the history in general. So, can you tell me, can the historical genetics and evolution of tactile interfaces predict the future of haptics, or maybe can it help us to learn from the mistakes?
Yeah, I mean, so I don't, prediction is tough, right? And there have been, anyone who gives a timeline for haptics technology will probably get it wrong, you know. So I think that is, for me, it's really fascinating not to try to do prediction, but to try to look at prediction, to try to look at, to try to learn from past predictions. For instance, one of my favorite examples of this is Howard Rheingold in his book, Virtual Reality. He's writing about teledildonics. He's writing about like cyber sex, yeah, remote sex technologies in 1990. And he says that basically like in 30 years, we may all have these, like, he calls them portable telediddlers that we carry around with us. And basically like remote sex has become normalized. And so Rheingold, like, he gave a date, right? He said 30 years out. And
he was wrong.
He was wrong, but he wasn't entirely wrong, right? So it's not that it's not been ubiquitously deployed, but I would say of all the areas of haptics research, and you know, haptics researchers like to treat that area of haptics like at a little bit of arm's length, right? But I would say that that's one area where we've seen like the successful commercialization of haptics technologies is in the area of cyber sex. It's not ubiquitous, but it's more ubiquitous than like haptic gloves are, for instance, for sure. Right. So the point is Rheingold gave a date, and we could, you know, we can look back and say like, oh, he got this right, he got this wrong. But I think it's interesting. What's more instructive is to try to learn from those predictions, right? To try to learn what people were thinking when they made a prediction, to try to learn where they might have gone wrong. So, you know, if we look back at the discourse around haptics, the marketing discourse around haptics from the late 1990s, when Logitech is selling force feedback, little vibrating computer mice, early 2000s, Microsoft is partnering with Immersion and developing like force feedback racing steering wheels. The rhetoric, the description of what those technologies were going to do, how they were going to transform gaming, is almost word for word the same as you find in marketing language for contemporary haptic vests, haptic gloves, right? So was that necessarily the best pitch? Did they set themselves up for failure by overpromising? I sort of think that one of the problems that the industry has had for a long time is it has overpromised, right? It's ratcheted the rhetoric up so high that the products it releases can't possibly deliver on that, deliver on those promises. It can't possibly cash the check that was written around it because they've said that it's going to do so much, right?
Yeah, but maybe they also drive the interest, right, and motivation for further research or some development. Might be not in a good direction, who knows, but, the money is brought to the industry anyway, so some part of it could be used for a good, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. We can also look, it seems like we can look back at those, a lot of those devices and see how they, how and why they fell short, or look at the way that people reacted to them. Maybe the way that people used them in ways that the designers didn't necessarily intend to. And I'll just give a quick example here. So the Novant Falcon is one of my favorite historical examples of, haptics really? Device successfully brought to market. You could go to Walmart or Best Buy and buy one off the shelf. Right. They had them, they had them pretty widely distributed in stores. Novant was asking people to be haptics evangelists. They were asking people basically to host like Tupperware parties for the Falcon, where you'd invite a bunch of your friends over and you would show them how the device worked. And that would generate this sort of grassroots groundswell of interest in the device and in haptics more generally. And you would end up with, this thing being widely deployed as a, as a gaming controller. The device fails, like dramatically fails, right? The company folds. They're closing out the devices for like $50 at Best Buy. But what does it do? it puts very cheap haptic interfaces in the hands of a lot of people who then start playing and doing creative things with the technology, right? So it's failure, but it's also a generative failure mm-hmm. that I think can be interesting to look back on and see where the interest clustered. Was the interest that emerged in the places that the designers and the marketers thought it would be, or did people do something creative and unexpected with technology at the grassroots level? And I think that's kind of been missing from the history of haptics. We haven't quite seen that like tinkerer hacker level of interest in the technology, I think, until just the past like 5 or 10 years or so. But you know, for the most part, it's been a very elite. It's been a very elite controlled field. In other words, like people working in university contexts, people working in industry contexts, not necessarily like on the ground users tinkering with the technology, trying to do something cool and interesting with it.
So you think that could be in a way like partially a future of haptic, right? These grassroots UI communities, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So basically give haptics to people.
See what they do with it. Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. I think we can basically end them if not. Thank you for your conversation, really. And thanks for your time and sharing your experience, your thoughts, your ideas. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been a really fun conversation. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Internet of Senses Institute podcast. If you like this episode, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Please visit our website at internetofsenses.com to learn more about multisensory technology. You can also follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram to stay connected.